Hey guys, it's Samuel, and welcome back to Voices of Voluntarism for another week in Anjo, covering October 5th through the 11th. James is not with me right now. For those of you that know James or have him added on Facebook, you know he had a pretty bad diabetic episode on Friday, and he basically spent all of Friday and Saturday recovering from that diabetic episode. And now he's doing a lot better, and he's actually at work right now. So it basically kind of threw a wrench in all of our plans for this weekend. So here I am on my lonesome doing a week in Anjo. So hopefully it won't be too bad. I expect it to be a little shorter than normal because there won't be a lot of back and forth, won't be a lot of conversation. But with that said, check out the recent interview that we posted. It was from James and Mr. Peaches. I was not a part of that. But make sure that you check that out, and with that said, we'll get right into it. So this first article was posted by Ryan Bauer on Saturday, October 5th. This comes from HKFP and was written by Holmes Chan. The headline is, Hong Kong Democrats to challenge mask ban in court accuse leader Carrie Lam of, quote, usurping legislature. So Hong Kong's pro-democracy lawmakers will challenge the newly imposed mask ban in court, arguing that Chief Executive Carrie Lam broke the law when she bypassed the legislature. Filed jointly by all 24 Democrats, the lawsuit targeted the Emergency Regulations Ordinance, or ERO, the colonial-era law that grants the city's leader and her council of advisors wide-ranging powers to, quote, make regulations on occasions of emergency or public danger. Democrats called for the mask ban to be suspended before a proper judicial review hearing can be held. The court will hear their first round of arguments at Sunday, 10 a.m. The lawmakers that said Lam circumvented the constitutional framework of one country, two systems when she invoked the ERO to ban facial coverings at legal and unauthorized protests from Saturday. Quote, since the handover, there has never been an occasion when the chief executive enacted legislation without going through LegCo, said civil party lawmaker Dennis Kwok. In a televised message broadcast earlier on Saturday, Lam said that the protesters were responsible for a, quote, very dark night in Hong Kong as she defended her use of the ERO. Quote, the Hong Kong SAR is determined to stop violence. I urge you to support the SAR government to stop violence in accordance with the law, condemn violence, and be determined in severing ties with rioters, she said. Kwok said that Lam was not intent on listening to the public's demands and that she would not stop at the anti-mask regulation. Quote, Lam sounded like she did 6 months ago when she was promoting the anti-extradition bill and said her critics misunderstood the law, he said. Quote, it proves that the chief executive has learned nothing, who has no humility, and cannot accept she was wrong. So, basically, Carrie Lam is doing the exact same thing with what she did with the extradition bill. When it comes to the face mask ban, first off, it's not going to do anything. It's just another reason for police to promote violence and escalate things to violence because they'll just, you know, point and say, hey, look, their faces are covered. They're breaking the law even more. So we need to, you know, we need to make them stop. It's also another reason to throw them in jail, another reason to fine them. It's another reason to demonize the people of Hong Kong. And Carrie Lam, like the article said, like it was quoted, you know, she is completely just playing the role of being fucking oblivious and not seeing what the consequences are going to be, and she's not trying to actually appeal to the protesters. But moving forward, this next article was posted by myself on Monday, October 7th. This article comes from the Washington Post and was written by Shibani Matani. The headline is, Hong Kongers ignore mask ban and march in huge numbers, showing that it just didn't do anything at all. So covering their faces with black surgical masks, Guy Fawkes disguises, dish towels, and even paper bags, tens of thousands in Hong Kong marched in the territory's two main districts in defiance of a government ban on face masks. Despite fears of violence and pouring rain, the march, which until late noon remained peaceful, underscored the depth of dissent over the new measures that many here believe to be an infringement on their fundamental freedoms. despite a partial shutdown of the city's subway system, including stations close to the starting point of the rallies. Participants included the disabled in wheelchairs, toddlers, and senior citizens. Quote, "To me, banning the masks is an erosion of our basic rights," said 60-year-old Fred Wong as he marched towards central Hong Kong in a green surgical mask. Quote, "We, as the older ones, should be ashamed of ourselves for not protecting our rights a long time ago, and we should be embarrassed if we don't come out to fight for the future of the young." The size and diversity of the marches showed that many remained undeterred and unwilling to give up their demands for a more democratic Hong Kong, even as the risks of protests continue to increase. The Hong Kong government is under growing pressure from authorities in Beijing to quell the anger that has erupted on city streets and in demonstrations that are now in their fifth month. So it's beautiful to see that this stuff is not slowing down, and it's one of the things that I've always admired about Asia, because you saw it with Japan when they had the nuclear reactor meltdown, but the elderly there are generally very mindful of the youth, and they understand that, you know, you have to, like, the future is not theirs. The future is for their descendants. It's for those that came after them. And I wish that more people in the United States would see that, because the government that has been formed and has crippled the United States by the boomer generation was basically acting on a very selfish motive, whereas they just did not stop to consider, you know, what they were doing to the country for future generations. And it's good to see that the people of Hong Kong, the elderly people of Hong Kong, are actually taking note of that and going out and protesting. But moving forward, this next article was posted by Ryan Bauer on Tuesday, October 8th. This comes from CBC, and the headline is, "Hong Kong leader says Chinese military could step in if situation, quote, becomes so bad." Hong Kong's leader Carrie Lam warned Tuesday that the Chinese military could step in if an uprising for democratic reforms that has rocked the city for months, quote, becomes so bad, but reiterated the government still hopes to resolve the crisis itself. Lam urged foreign critics to accept that the 4 months of protests marked by escalating violence were no longer, quote, a peaceful movement for democracy. She said seeking Chinese intervention was provided for under Hong Kong's constitution, but that she cannot reveal under what circumstances she will do so. Quote, "I still strongly feel that we should find the solutions ourselves. That is also the position of the central government, that Hong Kong should tackle the problem on her own, but if the situation becomes so bad, then no options could be ruled out if we want Hong Kong to at least have another chance," she told at a news conference, or she told a news conference. So, I don't see the protests slowing down. I mean, 5 months in, and they're still going. I really just don't see that slowing down or stopping. So there is a good chance we will eventually see Chinese intervention. And that's when shit's going to hit the fan and get hairy. That's when we have the potential for another Tiananmen Square event. So I hope that they keep up the good fight, that they keep fighting for their freedom. Again, reiterate, it kind of sucks that they're aiming for democracy instead of total abolition of government. But, I mean, they're moving in the right direction. They're actually willing to stand up and fight for something. So that's good to see. Wish I could see it in the United States. But moving forward, this next article was posted by James Freeman, who is not the piece of shit sitting next to me. He's the piece of shit at work right now. It was posted on Friday, October 11th. It comes from NBC News and was written by David K. Lee and Suzanne C. Chalsky. The headline is, "Free Hong Kong signs confiscated at Wizards basketball game." So, moving into a little bit of American news regarding Hong Kong, I'm sure that people that have been following it have also seen the incidents with Blizzard and with the NBA, and now with fans of these things. But China is effectively using their death grip on the market and being big investors in a lot of American businesses. They're using that to censor people that are not within their borders. So the article opens, several people at a Washington Wizards basketball game Wednesday against a Chinese team said their signs supporting anti-government demonstrations in Hong Kong and protesting the treatment of an ethnic group in China were confiscated. The action follows a similar incident Tuesday when two fans were kicked out of a Philadelphia 76ers game because they carried small handmade signs supporting anti-government demonstrators in Hong Kong. A group of people at the Wizards game said their signs were confiscated at Capital One Arena in Washington during a game against the Guangzhou Long Lions of the Chinese Basketball Association. Another person said he was told to ditch his sign supporting Hong Kong or leave, and he chose to leave. So, jumping into the next article, which really ties in with this, this one comes from Ryan Bauer and was posted on Monday, October 7th. This comes from COS and was written by Nina Corcoran. The headline is, South Park banned in China following, quote, banned in China episode. So South Park is now banned in China after airing an episode called Banned in China. The episode mocked Hollywood for alternating film and TV to better please the Chinese government. Beijing responded by scrubbing the show from the internet, like the entire thing. In Banned in China, co-creators Trey Parker and Matt Stone intentionally take aim at Hollywood's editorial tweaking to avoid Chinese government censors, all while seemingly knowing their Comedy Central show would take a hit as a result, hence the episode's name. They were right. Virtually, quote, every clip, episode, and online discussion of the TV show has been wiped from Chinese streaming services, discussion platforms, and social media, notes The Hollywood Reporter. For example, when fans type in the URL for the former South Park thread on Baidu's Taiba? I'm guessing that's Baidu's Taiba. China's largest online discussion platform, a message pops up that reads, quote, according to the relevant law and regulation, this section is temporarily not open. So, kudos to the creators of South Park, kudos to the team at South Park for basically putting the middle finger up and saying, fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. But we need to see more American businesses do this. We really need to see more businesses step up to the plate, say fuck you to the Chinese dollar, and not bow down to them because they want to censor speech. But it's good to see that at least someone, and especially with people with as big a voice as South Park, are, you know, actually taking a stand on the side of freedom for this and not caring about the financial hit that is inevitably going to come from it. But moving forward out of Hong Kong news, I've actually got two articles basically going over some protests that have erupted in Iraq, of all places. So getting into it, this article was posted by Ryan Bauer on Sunday, October 6th. This comes from the Anti-Media and was written by Tyler Durden. I am probably rightfully assuming a pseudonym. But the headline is, Martial Law Unfolding in Iraq. 30 protesters dead, internet blackout, and 24-hour curfews. Now in their third day, mass anti-government protests across Iraq have resulted in 30 dead and over 1,000 wounded amid a brutal police crackdown, which has involved unprepared security forces firing live rounds on demonstrators. Several major cities are now under curfew, and the government has cut internet access for much of the country. In a signal of just how dire and growing the mayhem is, Iran has now sealed key border crossings with Iraq just ahead of an annual Shia pilgrimage this month, where crucial Iran-Iraq border crossings swell with pilgrims. Baghdad is now under round-the-clock curfew as of Thursday after unrest started Tuesday, reportedly driven chiefly by youth and fueled by popular anger over corruption, unemployment, and the lack of basic services. Government authorities have said extreme measures are necessary to prevent, quote, infiltrators from attacking police and public property. The AFP reports the latest Thursday night, thousands of protesters clashed with riot police in Iraq's capital and across the south on Thursday, the third day of mass rallies that have left 30 dead. Quote, we'll keep going until the government falls, pledged 22-year-old Ali, an unemployed university graduate. Quote, I've got nothing but 250 lira, or 20 U.S. cents, in my pocket, while government officials have millions, he told AFP. So the protest train ain't stopping. It's definitely becoming a pattern right now with a lot of like anti-government protests, like severe ones are cropping up. But the thing that worries me about the ones in Iraq is there are still American troops over there, and it wouldn't take much. Like if the protesters get a little too organized, like they have in Hong Kong. You see, Iraq has the guns, unlike Hong Kong, and they actually are equipped to carry out a revolution. But with the presence of American troops, it would be really easy for the United States government to basically just label them an insurgent group or a terrorist group, and then quell the or like violently cut down the protests themselves. So, hoping that doesn't happen. But moving forward, this next article was posted by Peyton Guzian on Wednesday, October 9th. This comes from the 71 Republic and was written by Dane Larson. The headline is, "Who is Abdul Wahab al-Sadi, the man behind Iraq's deadly protests?" Amidst the impeachment inquiry initiated by Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the vicious fight for the Democratic nomination, a deadly protest has emerged in Iraq regarding the actions of the government against Abdul Wahab al-Sadi. A humanitarian disaster is occurring in Iraq due to the government's handling of anti-corruption protests. Abdul Wahab al-Sadi served as the Lieutenant General of Iraq's Counterterrorism Service, which was created in 2003. He is the man who helped defeat the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, in key battles against the Caliphate. The U.S.-Iraqi coalition, quote, the Golden Division, has earned al-Sadi praise for destroying ISIS and other groups. Al-Sadi recently visited the United States Embassy in Baghdad in an act to receive his annual work visa. He stated that his objective was to obtain said visa because of a scheduled speech at Harvard about terrorism, as he had done one year prior. The Iraqi government caught word of this and immediately jumped to conclusions about an under-the-table deal between the United States military and the Iraqi CTS. Prime Minister Adel Abdul Mahdi feared the removal of himself from office, and with the help of CTS General Talib Shangadi, they were able to remove al-Sadi from a position of power. The actions of the 10th most corrupt country in the world, based on Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index, led to the demotion of Abdul Wahab al-Sadi from his position in the CTS. He was transferred to the Ministry of Defense, where he would be given little to no power. Abdul Wahab al-Sadi disavowed such acts publicly, but most reports were silenced by agencies under Prime Minister Adel Abdul Mahdi. The people of Iraq took to the streets to express their disapproval. Al-Sadi still is a very popular figure for contributing to the downfall of ISIL. Directly following the forced resignation of al-Sadi, the Iraqi people rallied behind this cause. The people of Iraq, both Sunnis and Shiite, have joined together in their desire to eradicate corruption within their government. And for those of you guys that don't really know a whole lot about Islam, I personally don't know a lot, but I do know that the Sunnis and the Shiites are basically longtime enemies. So for them to be coming together like this, it's a pretty big fucking deal. But a substantial buildup of distrust for the government and discontent for personal and national economic conditions climaxed on October 1st. With the first case of organized citizen protests, Iraqi revolutionaries erupted in Baghdad, Mosul, Abadan, and other large cities within the nation. After multiple deaths on the first day, the Iraqi prime minister put into place a curfew to maintain order and protect protesters from, quote, infiltrators, and the protesters continued to take to the streets in the middle of the night, leading to more bloodshed. So, shit's kicking off pretty fucking fast and with a bang over in Iraq, against their government for corruption. Now, as we all know, one of the biggest reasons that the United States invades countries in the Middle East is to destabilize them, is to keep them from being able to get on their feet. If you look back to, say, the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you can look at countries like Afghanistan, you can look at countries like Iraq, or like Syria, or Lebanon, and they were very thriving, progressive cities. Like, women were not forced to, like, women and men alike were not forced to adhere to Sharia law. Women did not have to cover their heads or their faces or their hair. It was when the government, the United States government, kind of started helping plant radical governments like the Taliban, that shit kind of started spiraling. But just a few decades back, the Middle East was a beautiful, thriving place until foreign interference allowed basically religious extremists to establish a theocracy all across the Middle East. But I hope that the government, like the United States government, doesn't fuck this up and the Iraqi people can actually take back their land and their country and actually get back on the path of being what they used to be. But with that said, that brings us to the, or brings us, well, technically still us, brings us to the end of our first segment. So we are going to get into our first wild card of the night, which is our ace card. And this one was posted by Jason Booth on Wednesday, October 9th. This comes from CNS News and was written by Terrence Jeffrey. The headline is, Americans spent more on taxes in 2018 than on food, clothing, and healthcare combined. So Americans, on average, spent more on taxes in 2018 than they did on the basic necessities of food, clothing, and healthcare combined, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics Consumer Expenditure Survey. The survey's recently published Table R1 for 2018 lists the average, quote, detailed expenditures of what the BLS calls consumer units. Quote, consumer units, says BLS, include families, single persons living alone or sharing a household with others, but who are financially independent, or two or more persons living together who share major expenses. In 2018, according to Table R1, American consumer units spent an average of $9,031.93 on federal income taxes, $5,023.73 on Social Security taxes, which the table calls, quote, deductions, $2,284.62 on state and local income taxes, $2,199.80 on property taxes, and $77.85 on what BLS calls, quote, other taxes. The combined payments the average American consumer unit made for these five categories of taxes was $18,617.93. At the same time the average American consumer unit was paying these taxes, it was spending $7,923.19 on food, $4,968.44 on healthcare, and $1,866.48 on, quote, apparel and services. These combined expenditures equaled $14,758.11. So that's almost a whole $4,000 more that you pay in taxes than you do for your basic needs. So, and that's healthcare included, but this is just kind of absurd. And let's see, it was federal income tax, Social Security tax, state and local income tax, property tax, and other tax. So chances are that is not factoring in sales tax, which would also be a big one. But that would actually, that I don't know if the numbers for how much they paid for their basic needs included the sales tax, but if it was pre-tax, that would, or if it was post-tax, that would actually shave off some money spent on your needs and would add it on to the actual amount that you paid for taxes. But it's just kind of obscene and absurd how much we spend. And naturally, you know, the socialists want to, you know, hike taxes, make it even worse for whatever programs they decide that they, you know, deem as worthy of stealing money from people. And then you have the Republicans that want to steal more money so that they can pour it all into the military, so they can keep terrorizing those damn dirty brown people over in the Middle East. So, it's horseshit. But with that said, I'm gonna take a small break, and then we'll get right back into it with the second segment of A Week in Anjo. Mic check, fuck you.
Fuck!
Alright, and I am back. Still on my lonesome, but getting right into it for the second segment of A Week in Anjo. And this first article comes from Brian Tracy and was posted on Tuesday, October 8th. This comes from Como News. The headline is, several guns seized from Redmond man after, quote, concerning Twitter posts for Joker movie. So a 23-year-old Redmond man, who police say made, quote, concerning Twitter posts posing with weapons and referencing the Joker movie, has had several guns, including two assault weapons, excerpt for myself, that's not a legitimate classification, but removed from his home as part of an extreme protection order, Redmond police said. Investigators became aware of the posts last week, including one dated September 26th, showing the man holding two AK-47 guns, one in each hand, pointing skyward, fingers on the triggers. So, poor trigger discipline. But the caption on the photo read, quote, one ticket for Joker, please, according to Redmond police. The post comes as U.S. officials had issued warnings about the potential for mass shootings at the movie, which opened on Thursday to increase security around the Seattle area movie theaters. FBI intelligence officials had uncovered social media posts related to extremists classified as incels, short for involuntary celibate, and the man had been claiming to be one of them. Investigators learned that the man had previous disturbing and threatening social media posts towards women in 2017, and according to Redmond's police petition for being granted an extreme protection order. So dude's an incel. I can't defend him on those grounds. At all. Incels are inherently pieces of shit. Usually. They're typically people that have nice guy syndrome that think that they're just, you know, God's gift to the green earth. When in reality, they are just very selfish and self-centered assholes. So this really is kind of trademark behavior of an incel. But to basically infringe on their human right to own a firearm, you know, for whatever reason, typically self-defense, he hadn't done anything criminal with those firearms. If he had, that'd be a whole nother fucking story. But he didn't. He made some stupid-ass fucking posts I don't even think it actually says where he posted them. Oh, Twitter. He posted them on Twitter. He made some really retarded tweets, and his guns have been seized from him. So again, it's kind of hard to defend the guy in question, because I don't know, incels, I just can't really defend an incel. But at the same time, this is overreaching government action, and I just can't get behind that. If James was here, I know that he would have a lot of funny shit to say about this. So, fuck you, James, even though it was partly my decision to do this on my own today. But moving forward, this next article was posted by Ruth Langmore on Sunday, October 6th. This article comes from This Blows My Mind and was written by Laura Ramirez. Headline is, man asks valid question. Quote, why am I taxed on the social energy that I create myself, or that I generate myself? So this is coming out of Canada. So a man who designed and built his own home, especially so that he wouldn't have to pay tax on his energy bills, has had to do exactly that. Chris Curry had a dream of going off-grid and went about finding how he could transform his home into an energy-creating complex. He built his house in New Dominion, Prince Edward Island, Canada, so that every aspect of it was designed to create energy. He dreamt of not paying any money to the government for energy that he planned to make all himself. But he got a nasty shock when he received a bill for tax on every kilowatt produced per hour in his home. His net zero home led him to believe that he wouldn't have to pay this kind of tax, however the HST, or Harmonized Sales Tax, still charged him. Despite paying absolutely zero for his energy bills, he still has to pay a monthly for a tax despite incurring no charges. This bizarre setup is just another one of the government's schemes to dissuade people from living off-grid, and just recently the U.S. government put a stop to people building their own eco-friendly tiny homes. Curry spent $46,000 on building his own solar-paneled house in the hope that the government would not be hassling him about energy bills. Sadly, he was wrong. Kind of just goes to show they don't want you breaking away. They do these things. Like, the America is more severe with it. They pull shit like Ruby Ridge. But it's all to dissuade people from living off-grid. Because if you're living off-grid and you're living in a completely self-sustaining way, you're not contributing with taxes. You may ask yourself, well, yeah, it's just one person, you know, why would they be so upset about that? Well, it's the precedent that it sets. And if too many people start living off-grid, then it becomes a revenue issue for the government. So they're trying to dissuade it as much as possible. But moving forward into the next article, this one was posted by James Freeman on Sunday, October 6th. The article comes from Fox News and was written by Lin-Ann Nguyen. The headline is, Amber Geiger's legal team expected to appeal murder conviction. So legal experts believe Amber Geiger's legal team will likely appeal her murder conviction. A jury sentenced the former Dallas police officer on Wednesday to 10 years in prison for murdering Botham Jean, her upstairs neighbor, at the Southside Flats apartment in September of 2018. Although Geiger's trial is done, the case is likely far from over. Trial observers like defense attorney Heath Harris are looking ahead to what could happen with Geiger's murder conviction in appeals court. Harris is not affiliated with the case. He has experience as a former prosecutor on police cases and believes Geiger's attorneys will move aggressively to get a new trial. Quote, they're going to throw everything just like they did in this trial, Harris said. Quote, they're going to throw everything they have at the appellate court, hoping something sticks, hoping something gives them another chance at retrying this case. And this also follows one of the key witnesses, a key character witness in the trial, was gunned down in a drive-by shooting. He was shot in the mouth. But the police tried to say that basically some people drove from Louisiana all the way to Texas to buy weed from him, which is fucking horseshit. Nobody drives that distance in the United States to get weed. Like, why would you do that? And then kill the guy that you just drove 300 or 400 miles to buy weed from. Why the fuck would you do that? It's completely unrealistic. It's playing off of this idea, I guess, that the police have, that, you know, we're, a lot of us have not bought weed and don't understand how this works. But most people have. Most people know that you don't drive that kind of distance to buy weed. Like, chances are you can find plenty of plugs within your own city. So their little explanation there is fucking horseshit. But moving forward, we'll be looking at that and seeing what happens. Chances are it's going to get overturned. I feel like it's genuinely going to get overturned. But moving forward, this next article was posted by Peyton Guzian on Wednesday, October 9th. It is from the 71 Republic and is also written by Peyton Guzian. The headline is, Defense Intelligence Agency Employee Arrested After Leaking Classified Information. So we have another arrest of a whistleblower. But the Justice Department announced the arrest of an employee at the Defense Intelligence Agency. The employee had been arrested for allegedly disclosing national defense information to two journalists, one in 2018 and another in 2019. Assistant Attorney General for National Security John C. Demers claims the employee, quote, was caught red-handed disclosing sensitive national security information for personal gain. The employee, Henry Kyle Fries, holds top secret sensitive compartmented information security clearance. Fries is reported as accessing classified information reports related and unrelated to his duties. One report regarded top secret information regarding a foreign country's weapons systems. This information was provided to the first journalist. According to the indictment, 1 week after accessing the first report, Journalist 1 put Fries in contact with Journalist 2. Fries agreed to contact with Journalist 2 if it would, quote, help Journalist 1. He is quoted as saying he wanted to see Journalist 1 progress. Fries allegedly spoke with Journalist 1 about the topic of the first intelligence report before accessing the report later. He then spoke to both journalists over the phone, and hours after Journalist 1 published an article relating to the topic of the first intelligence report. On September 24th, 2019, Fries was caught, based on surveillance of his cell phone, orally transmitting classified NDI to Journalist 2. Disclosures made are classified at the secret level, and this means it is expected disclosure of the information could be harmful to national security, according to the Defense Intelligence Agency. a federal grand jury returned an indictment that charges Freeze with two counts of, quote, willful transmission of national defense information to persons not entitled to receive it. If Freeze is convicted, he will serve a maximum of 10 years in prison per charge. An assistant U.S. Attorney Danya E. Atiyah and trial attorney Jennifer Kennedy Gilley of the National Security Division's Counterintelligence and Export Control Section are on the prosecution for the case. So, this guy isn't like the Bradley Manning or the Edward Snowden of the leaking information world, but kudos to you for having the balls to fucking do it, honestly. Like, I have a lot of respect for people that work themselves up to getting, like, high levels of security clearance and then just completely leaking shit out. But moving forward from that, this next article was posted by Jason Booth on Thursday, October 10th. It comes from Fox News and was written by Brittany DeLee. The headline is, IRS audits more poor taxpayers because it's easier and cheaper than targeting the rich. Instead of going after the wealthy, the IRS has been under fire for targeting lower-income taxpayers with audits, which the agency now says is partially because it is easier and can be accomplished with less skilled employees. When questioned by Oregon Democrat Senator Ron Wyden as to why a large proportion of lower-income taxpayers are being audited, IRS Commissioner Charles Rettig admitted it is a much easier and less costly task when compared with auditing higher income tax returns. Correspondence audits, which are often used to look into low income people claiming earned income tax credit, cost just $150. EITC correspondence audits are the most efficient use of available IRS examination resources, with the average time to complete the audit of 5 hours per return, Rettig explained in a letter. By comparison, the time it takes to complete an audit for a taxpayer with an adjusted gross income of $10 million or more is 61 to 251 hours per return. Further, due to the required degree of employee experience and skill set, the IRS said it cannot, quote, simply shift examination resources from the simpler audits to the more complex ones. There is also a higher turnover rate among these more experienced auditors, who generally have, quote, substantial accounting skills, among other qualifications. In order to audit more high-income returns, the agency said it would need more funding from Congress, which would allow it to have, quote, appropriately balanced coverage across all income levels. So, basically, they refuse to audit the rich. They audit the poor as much as they possibly can because it's easier for them. And they're basically saying it's too expensive. It's too expensive to audit the rich. And you're going to have to give us more money, if they get more money, chances are that's an increase in taxes, which I could just see them, again, shifting all that money to just targeting the poor even more, because the poor can't fight it like the rich can. But that's just another example of crony capitalism at its best, really. But this next article was posted by Brian Tracy on Monday, October 7th. This comes from Herald Net and was written by Jerry Cornfield. Headline is, lack of staff puts collection of tax bounty at risk. So a lack of staff threatens the state's ability to ensure $1.2 billion from a slew of new taxes is collected for the budget. The Department of Revenue says it needs 44 more people, 17 now and another 27 in the next fiscal year, to handle added responsibilities created by 32 revenue bills signed into law earlier this year. Agency leaders want to hire information specialists to help taxpayers understand what they may owe, examiners and auditors to ensure compliance with the laws, and legal support for an expected increase in appeals and other disputes. They are asking for $4.1 million in the 2020 supplemental budget to cover the added costs. Quote, the agency was significantly underfunded for the 32 revenue bills that passed during the 2019 legislative session, wrote department leaders in the budget request they submitted to Governor Jay Inslee in September. As a result, they told him the current staffing level is, quote, inadequate and insufficient to ensure that the agency will be able to collect revenues associated with those new laws. Inslee is reviewing funding requests from state agencies and will propose a supplemental spending plan in December. Quote, we'll take a look at it with all the other decision packages, said Tara Lee, Inslee's spokeswoman. So this is just another example of poor government planning. Like, they're just so blinded by their greed of new taxes. 32 new revenue bills passed into law. 32 to increase taxes. And they were just so dead set eyes on the prize of getting them passed that they didn't even think to compensate for them. But it's kind of funny to see that they might not get these taxes because they're not going to have the funding to collect them. But moving forward past that, this next article was posted by Jason Booth on Sunday, October 6th. The article comes from Reason and was written by Eric Boehm. The headline is, $100 million for a minor league ballpark. So, to clear space for a new minor league baseball stadium, the city of Worcester, Massachusetts, is using eminent domain to condemn and seize two successful businesses. City officials then plan to put Worcester's remaining taxpayers on the hook for more than $100 million to build the ballpark and do some adjacent redevelopment. It's hard to say which part of the plan is worse, stealing private land or wasting public dollars. Worcester initially tried to buy out the owners of an auto repair glass or an auto glass repair shop and a cannabidiol retailer, but the businesses turned down the offers of $310,000 and $265,000 respectively, according to court documents. When the property holders refused, Worcester officials resorted to eminent domain to get their way. The city council approved the takings in April, booting out the businesses despite their owners' objections, and a groundbreaking for the city-owned stadium project went ahead in July. But the eminent domain effort could take months to finalize in court, and that could force the city to delay the opening of the new stadium planned for spring of 2021. The ballpark will be the new home for the Boston Red Sox's top minor league affiliate, and the team is relocating from Pawtucket, Rhode Island, where it has played since 1970 after spurning an offer from Rhode Island officials to use a measly $38 million in public funds to upgrade the 76-year-old stadium where the team currently plays. Instead, the Woo Sox, as local media have taken to calling them, will get a shiny new ballpark. The Worcester taxpayers will get a pile of debt. So this is like just layers of fucked up. First, they're like, okay, hey, we want to build a ballpark. It's we need your land, so we're going to give you this money, and you're going to give us your land. And then they refuse, so it's like, oh, wait, we're the government. We're just going to fucking take it anyways. But eminent domain and this it's basically, you know, civil asset forfeiture for land. It is just blatant theft. It's horseshit. Like, the government should not be able to, under any circumstances, take someone's private property, regardless of compensation. But I really feel sorry for Worcester, Massachusetts. That $100 million could go to a lot of better things, but, you know, the empire needs its coliseums. But with that said, that brings us into the second wild card of the night and the end of the second segment, and a week in Anjo. So jumping right into it, this is our Joker card. It was posted by Jason Booth on Saturday, October 5th. This comes from Fox News and was written by Joseph A. Wolfson. The headline is, Kamala Harris asks audience if America is ready for her presidency. Crowd shouts no. So Senator Kamala Harris, Democrat of California, may have had what some are calling her please clap moment on Thursday when she got a not-so-favorable response to the question if America was ready for her to be president. Speaking at a town hall event in Reno, Nevada, Harris told attendees she wanted to, quote, engage in real talk about the state of the 2020 race. Quote, in this election, in the last couple, I mean, maybe couple of months, certainly a few weeks, there's this whole conversation that has been coming up about electability focused on our campaign. Is America ready for that? Several audience members were then heard responding no throughout the room, with Harris visibly shocked by what she heard. Quote, well, yes they are, Harris told the crowd, sparking some laughter. The exchange received mockery on social media, many comparing it to the memorable moment from the 2016 election when former Governor Jeb Bush, Republican of Florida, urged a crowd at a campaign stop to, quote, please clap. Which, that was a hilarious fucking moment. Like, that was one of the most beautiful moments in politics. But it's good to see Kamala Harris got her own little please clap moment, so that was fucking beautiful. But Kamala Harris is a piece of shit. She has ruined the lives of many and laughs about it. So fuck her. She deserved this response. She deserves to be shouted no when she asks a question like that. So fuck her. Fuck everything she stands for. But all in all, that's fucking hilarious. But with that said, that brings us to the end of A Week in Anjo this go-around. First time doing it solo, so now me and James have done solo episodes, so that's fun. But little shorter than normal. I'm seeing in the software it's about 45 minutes. So, to be expected, I suppose. Don't forget to check out the interview that James did with Mr. Peaches yesterday. I don't know if I'm allowed to say his actual name. I feel like it would be beneficial, but he wanted to be called Mr. Peaches, so he's Mr. Peaches. But check out that interview from yesterday. James was still kind of recovering from his diabetic episode, so he said that it was a little all over the place, but I feel like that can make it a little fun. So with that said, don't forget to tune in this coming Wednesday for another episode of Down the Rabbit Hole, continuing our series on America's War on Americans. With that said, stay sexy and don't die.